Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
From Peace Corps volunteer in Cameroon to U.S. ambassador in Iraq, Christopher Hill has worked in some of the most dangerous hotspots of the past few decades. In his new book, Outpost, Life on the Front Lines of American Diplomacy, a memoir, he brings readers inside the rooms where modern history has been made. Hill's story is his take on life in the Foreign Service, from his childhood in Belgrade and Haiti, where his father was a diplomat, to the Peace Corps, working with credit unions in Cameroon, and after that, to his life in the State Department. Again, the title of the book is Outpost, Life on the Front Lines of American Diplomacy. We welcome Christopher Hill to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
At what point do you decide that you no longer want to have that life in the service? At what point is there an expiration date on doing what you had achieved for so many years?
Well, I think it's like a lot of things in life, a lot of walks of life. I mean, you want to leave when people are saying, what, you're leaving, rather than, you know, what, you're still here. So I felt after Iraq, which is probably our biggest post around the world, probably toughest issue, in fact, still is a tough issue, I thought that was a good time to call it quits.
When you look back in your time in service, what do you think there is about your character, there is about your makeup that made you be a good ambassador?
Well, I do a lot of listening. That is, you really need to understand the other guy's point of view, and that's sometimes an elusive concept for people. So I do try to listen. And I do try to think, is there a way through this where I might value something more than the other person values it? You kind of figure out if you can work a deal. So I'm just interested in the idea of going forward. And when you're a diplomat, that's sort of what you look for. When you're a lawyer, you kind of look back to see, you know, who shot John. But when you're a diplomat, you try to look forward and see if you can, you know, construct something that'll make something for the future. And that's what I like to do. I like to kind of keep looking ahead.
It is fascinating in the book because you write about working with Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, as well as Secretaries of State Albright and Rice and Clinton. A lot of different personalities there. How much do you have to alter your way of thinking to represent their worldview? And how much autonomy do you feel you have to express how you feel?
Well, certainly they are different personalities. And I must say, the further you go in this line of work, the more you have to kind of keep your head down. You got to be careful because you get into this kind of political realm, and you're, you know, often in the room with people who are looking at things very politically. And that's certainly what happens when you're dealing with the president. So what you try to do is give your best advice and kind of stay to what you feel is the right way forward and not anticipate how they look at it. Now, they may have a different perspective on it, but I think they want you there because you have some expertise. And I think it behooves you to kind of stick with that expertise rather than act as though you are some kind of new recruit to a political party, because you are not a political appointee. You are a person who's been doing this for a long time, and that's why they want to talk to you, because they think you can find the way forward to get out of whatever mess we're in.
And it seems in reading the book that there were varying levels of trust and understanding that those who I mentioned a moment ago had in your expertise.
Well, I think often what senior political people are looking for is someone who can kind of calmly go through the situation, lay out options, and explain how to go forward and get through some issues. So I sort of felt that I was able to do that. As the section on Richard Holbrooke might have suggested, I mean, he was quite a national asset, no question, but at times he was difficult for people to deal with, and it often fell to me to kind of mediate between him and other people who had come in during the Clinton administration. So ironically, the career guy, me, was better able to deal with the political appointee Holbrooke than some of his fellow political appointees.
You write in the book that the military is called on to perform tasks that are more diplomatic in nature than military and to fight wars with uncertain objectives. How did we get to that point, and can we turn that around, assuming we should?
Well, it's a complicated world out there, to be sure. And often people look to the United States to get engaged. You know, countries around the world will turn to us and say, well, why aren't you engaged in this, when they have no intention of being engaged themselves. So we are, you know, often kind of airdropped into messy circumstances. And I think one thing we have to keep in mind is to try to, not to jump into everything, and not certainly not allow people to push us into everything. But once we're in, I think we need to maybe do a better job of having clearer objectives. And, obviously the idea of going in with overwhelming force and, unconditional surrender, I'm afraid those days are over. The world is too messy a place for those kinds of neat and clean circumstances. But I think we do need to be a little careful about going into situations that we don't entirely understand. And I think so often we have misunderstood a problem overseas. For example, in Iraq, this was a problem of a country lying on the fault line between the Shia and Sunni worlds, less of a problem of the issue of the fault line between democracy and dictatorship. And I think often we look at these things more in terms of our own understanding, that is, that it's always between democracy and dictatorship, when it may be between sectarian identities that we don't understand as well. So I think we need to do a little better job of analyzing these things before we jump into, and certainly Syria is a case in point. I mean, it's not so much good guys and bad guys there. It tends to be bad guys and worse guys. And we've got to be very careful about what we do in a place like that.
I do want to go back to Iraq for a moment, because you are forever a diplomat. You are very diplomatic in how you treat many of the political personalities that you have dealt with over your time in service. However, if there is a human being and a character in this book who wears a black hat, it is former Vice President Dick Cheney. You write in the book that the failure of neoconservatives and their fellow travelers to explain what they were trying to accomplish in Iraq remains one of the most disgraceful performances by a foreign policy class in America. It has been a failure to acknowledge mistakes and a shameful effort to shift the blame, in the case of Iraq, to nameless intelligence analysts, and if they were responsible for the full court pressure on President Bush to convince him to go to war. And you, it seems, have more anger toward the vice president than you do the president.
Well, I think the president is managing a lot of different things. I mean, as a president, you're basically overseeing a kind of vast apparatus. You're overseeing a lot of appointees, and you need to rely on the people around you to give you good judgment and not kind of hem you in or put you in a corner such that you have no place to go. If I can speak freely, I think the vice president sometimes brought his own views more than he should have, and he should have anticipated what was best for the president. And I think the vice president, in putting his own views, which were often rather dire about things, and he kind of put the president in a box and made it very difficult for the president to make good decisions. I think the neoconservatives who pushed the Iraq war were less interested in the issue of weapons of mass destruction and were more interested in somehow adjudicating the last days of the Bush 41 administration. When Bush 41 refused to go into Baghdad, he and his Secretary of State, James Baker, refused to go into Baghdad because they realized that was fraught with difficult circumstances. And to see the neocons somehow saying, now's the opportunity to right that wrong, I think was not good service to our president. And it was particularly, for me, ironic when I was criticized in my efforts with North Korea as if I were carrying on my own foreign policy. I was not. I was carrying out the instructions of my Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, and the President. And these people seem to be indeed carrying on their own foreign policy, not necessarily listening to the President's wishes and not really helping him through these crises. So I think they do have a lot to answer for.
With a world at the time so weary of Iraq and a war that was then known to be started under false pretenses, was there a possibility of there being a winning situation of of the Obama administration and the president to get us out of there and not then at some point return to the position that we're in now?
Well, I think it was a tough circumstance. First of all, the idea that President Obama should take all the blame for the fact that we didn't have a residual force there merits some analysis. We didn't have a residual force in Iraq because the Iraqis could never agree that we should have a residual force. I mean, one of the conditions of President Obama, frankly, the condition of any president, is that if we're going to put Americans overseas, station them overseas, they need to have their U.S. constitutional rights. That is, they need to have immunities from local prosecution. And yet the Iraqi politicians, whether it was Maliki or the opposition or anybody there, they were not prepared to do that. And so you can only imagine the consequence had President Obama said, okay, well, we don't care about our soldiers' constitutional rights. We'll put them there anyway and subject them to Iraqi law. So I don't think the president really had much choice on this issue of putting a residual force there of troops that did not have immunities. But secondly, and I think this is also worth pointing out, whether we had had 5,000 troops left in Iraq or 10,000 troops, I don't think that could have changed the basic problem that we had Sunnis who were chafing under the idea of living under Shia rule. And the most radical of these, most extreme of these, were, of course, the people who eventually gathered under the ISIS banner. And so I'm not sure that would have changed if there were 10,000 U.S. troops in the country.
So if I'm reading the book correctly and if I'm hearing you correctly, we're going to be paying the price for some bad decisions for a long time.
Well, you know, whether Iraq, going into Iraq was a bad decision or not, I'll let the historians sort that out. I must say, when you live there, when you work there, when you see the sacrifice of fellow Americans, you don't want to tell those fellow Americans some years later, gee, what we were doing was all a very bad mistake. I will say, however, that we went in there without really understanding the situation. First of all, the notion that a Shia-led Iraq was going to be some kind of model for the Sunni-majority Middle East is a bit of a fiction, and I think it's time we called out people on that fact. So there are a lot of problems there. I'd rather adjudicate the past, as we started out talking about, I'd rather sort of go forward and see what we can do. Clearly, we need a Shia leadership that is a little more interested in, you know, bringing in the Sunnis. We're not going to find a Nelson Mandela in Iraq, unfortunately, but we need a Shia leadership that's a little better at that. And then we need a Sunni minority to kind of understand that the majority is going to rule in that country, and they have to get used to a Shia-led governance. So I think that's kind of the way forward. I think it's important for us to work with them, to continue to work with the Kurds, to have this kind of military mission that we've got in there, but to stop short of boots on the ground. And I think that's the way forward.
Are you optimistic that can happen?
Well, optimism and Iraq are not two words I've put together usually, but I think that is probably the best way forward. I think if we just left it lock, stock, and barrel, the problem would further metastasize, would cause problems all over the Middle East. So I think for now it's the best policy prescription, and let's hope the prescription is adequate to dealing with the disease.
I was fascinated in reading, and this goes back to the personality question I asked toward the beginning of our conversation, but working with these three incredible women who served as Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, Condoleezza Rice, and Hillary Clinton, again, very different personalities, but all seemed at their moments to have very significant impact on foreign diplomacy.
Well, first of all, three women in the as Secretaries of State in the last four or five secretaries. It is quite a remarkable number, except that when you realize that all the previous secretaries of state had been white males.
Right.
So it's not like women have caught up here. We need to see more women in senior leadership positions.
But you had a front seat. You got to witness a very important time in history.
I sure did. I sure did. And I would say all three of them were tended to be very tough-minded and looking forward and looking to see what the United States needed to do next. I mean, these were not people who kind of shied away from the challenges. I remember Madeleine Albright was very clear, you know, what do we have an army for if they're not willing to take on some of these issues of gross human rights abuses in the Balkans? And certainly, certainly Condoleezza Rice was not shy about these things either, nor, of course, Hillary Clinton. So they tended to be rather tough-minded people. They expected their staffs to be tough-minded and also kind of ready with options on what they should do. They tended to be very energetic people. They're three of our most traveled secretaries of state, certainly. They tended to want to see the problems firsthand and to be looking for solutions. So I would say we've had some pretty good secretaries of state lately.
The name of the book is Outpost: Life on the Front Lines of American Diplomacy. It is a memoir by Christopher Hill. Christopher Hill is currently the dean of the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He was a career diplomat, a four-time ambassador, nominated by three presidents. Christopher Hill, a great pleasure to have you join us and share your expertise. I thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Outpost: Life on the Front Lines of American Diplomacy. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.